But we get things rolling by welcoming into the program our friend, writer Colin Fleming. Hello there, Mr. Fleming.
How's it going, sir?
We're doing quite well, thank you. A lot of stuff to talk about today, but I want to begin by the second half of a conversation we started last time around. We're talking about the Beatles, A Hard Day's Night, and I wanted to go back to that a little bit and ask you if you think that film was as important, maybe even more important than their music was, in creating Beatlemania here in the States.
I think it was a distillation of what Beatlemania looked at in the much smaller world of England at the time. I'm not sure, though, that it really had that much of an impact one way or the other here in terms of what they became across the country, because when the Beatles had their first records put out by smaller labels like VJ in the fall of 1963, nothing happened. But what sometimes people don't realize is the Beatles had so many people trying to help them, backing them, as it were, along the way. For instance, before they even had a record deal, and then when they got a record deal, the friends and relatives, the mothers, sisters, all of that of the Beatles, they literally wrote hundreds of letters on their own time to try to advance their cause to radio stations and whatnot. And by the same token, Capitol really hooked the Beatles up when they finally latched onto them. I say finally, it was like they passed on three singles. It was a matter of a season and a half, really, with their marketing campaign. The Beatles could have come over and been absolute rubbish, and they were going to reign supreme in February 1964 because their name was plastered everywhere. A lot of people were going to tune in to see what they were because those people did not know what they were, and everyone wished to know what the hullabaloo was all about. Then you have the albums, the singles, the bastardized American albums, but I think a lot of it, what it comes down to with the Beatles, is something we've talked about before, and that's melody. People like the hummable tune, and they delivered that certainly at that point. And A Hard Day's Night was the locus of what this frenzy was behind the scenes. So it pulled back that curtain, and it palpitated with some of their energy. They were always a very energetic band, even when they did ballads. A lot of energy in My Life for Yesterday. But I don't think it really would have made any difference if that film had not been shot or was a shoddy work of cinema.
You talk about people trying to help them out, and we talked earlier in the summer with Tommy Rowe, and the Beatles opened for Tommy Rowe on a British tour, I think in 1963. He came back to America with tapes and tried to get his record company to sign him. They listened to a little bit of it, turned it off, and said to Tommy Rowe, "Why don't you just stick to singing, Tommy, and we'll be the one to find future hits."
Well, for instance, you know the situation I'm in. And a friend was saying to me the other day, he said, look, he was watching The Walking Dead, and he said that you have these herds of living zombies. And what life a lot comes down to then, and I think more so right now, is, as he pointed out, getting the herd to go to a certain place. And when the herd gets there, they're going to partake of what every other member of the herd is partaking of. Better yet, if it's, say, for instance, the best meal they've ever had. So when the tapes were offered of She Loves You and I Want to Hold Your Hand, it's not hard, right, to recognize the hook in She Loves You. There are, what, two dozen hooks, any one of which would define a successful career? And people on their own couldn't hear it, or those people couldn't hear it. But then later, I'm sure those same executives who passed bopped their head along to it in the car, got the records for their kids at Christmas. You need to get the herd to go in that direction. And I think right now we are in a post-entertainment, post-art world where you could have anything. And if the herd is all there, everyone else is going to say, oh, I'm really into this too. It doesn't have to be something that you're actually into. But when it is, and it's befitting something that you could actually love, as the Beatles certainly were, then you have something that transcends its moment, makes its moment, and is also timeless and will be listened to and talked about and felt and enjoyed and hummed along to for an awful lot of years after.
Colin, where do you rank A Hard Day's Night in any listing of great music-oriented films?
As a film, I would say it is the finest work of rock and roll related cinema for the large purpose of, if you took the Beatles in their musical existence away from the film, and it was just four unknown actors being cast in this particular cinematic travelogue, it holds up as a work of cinematic art, quite independent of what the Beatles were, the way it's shot, again, its energy, the camera angles, the close proximity of the scenes within the train, that captures what it's like to ambulate from one place to another. That is the filmic ultimate iteration of travel, of being harried, of being someone, too, who, no matter what you do, is questing, is trying to make something of yourself with purpose. It's a film of great purpose. And often now, we don't even know what purpose means. People don't have purpose. What they do to try to make up for a lack of purpose is say, so we have another kid because the two we have, another one will give me more purpose. And a lot of decisions are made that way. It's the filmic record, in my view, of a kind of artistic purity of purpose that also transcends art and is something that you can use in the rest of your life. A lot of that credit goes to Richard Lester, goes to the script, and it just goes to the phonetic way in which it was shot. It's a very pacey film.
We're talking with Colin Fleming here on Downtown. All right, I want to shift gears and talk about a wonderful piece you had on your blog at colinflemminglit.com. Three things you encounter dozens of times daily that terrify me. There's a reason I love you like the brother I never had. And it starts with number one. People who think should have is should of. I want to smack them upside the head.
Now, I've tried to repress this list, but as you mentioned, it just came back to me.
I'm sorry.
New each day. It's like F. Scott Fitzgerald, for instance. Now, this one is the most benign, although it's awfully infuriating, on the list. Someone like F. Scott Fitzgerald, he wrote euphonically. He wrote in terms of what he heard with his ears. So if you go through drafts of handwritten Fitzgerald stories, you will see H-E-R-E for H-E-A-R, right? You'll see all those kinds of things. So I understand that that's sometimes what's happening. But the should of, and you can hear when people say it, you can actually tell. Sometimes I'll be listening to something on, like, some sports program, and you can tell from the way that the person pronounces the second word, they think it's not H-A-V-E. They think it's of. And You'll see these people arguing vociferously on social media about how correct they are on some issue. And they're trying to pull intellectual rank on others. If you notice, a lot of times people do it with the construction y'all. Whenever you see y'all on Twitter now, it means two things. It means, one, I think I am super duper smart. Two, I'm also going to do a little virtue signaling while I'm here, y'all. And so you see those people with the should of rather than the should have. And it's like, oh my goodness, you need to get your house in order if you're going to be this kind of unpleasant person. At least be less of an ignorant one as you go about it.
Now, I have a companion piece when it comes to language annoyances that I will put with that one. It's the people who say, oh, it wasn't that big of a deal. Ow! That one hurts me.
You're not a fan. Well, you must see as a teacher, you must see the should of a lot.
Oh, I see should of constantly, yes.
They know the difference. And it's one thing, though, when you just screw up because you hear that sound in your ear. It's another thing when you're being a dick and
yes.
You're like, oh, yes, look at me just reigning over all of you peons, plebeians, should have, right? It's that person who needs to go to some sort of subterranean chamber in the earth and reside there, like a timeout until they fix it.
I'm good with that. Now, we've talked about your work running up and down the Bunker Hill Monument, and yet there are still people who seem shocked that it's easier coming down all those steps than going up.
I am so fresh from the monument right now. I just did five climbs. I barely got in. But I am technically in the nude, although I am wearing my sweat, as we say in the monument game. And so I heard this several times within the past hour. Yes, adults get to the top of the monument with their children, and it's 294 steps. And I would say, conservatively, 90% of the people who then descend the monument, which they labored to get up, you see really how poor fitness is in this country inside the monument, they will say either to their wife, their husband, their kids, with great incredulity in their voice, that it's easier going down. That's strange, right? Isn't it easier? Or sometimes the kid will say, how come it's easier going down? And the father will actually remark, I don't know. That's a good question. Now, I don't know if there's more of a basic tenet in reality than gravity. In fact, when Newton figured it out, his second thought should have been, why does this take so long? Oh, man, I should have thought of this before. I feel really dumb. But everybody will say this. And if you don't know what gravity is, I wonder what you can actually know. I don't know what's more basic than that. And it's one thing if people were having a lark, but they honestly don't know this. And their kids are pressing them for information, and they don't know what to tell the child. And you're not trying to, like, mess your child up so it's some ignoramus who's going to go out and not know the difference between should have and should have. But that's what you're setting the child up to be. And I will tell you, it's also as a side note, it is very depressing the number of Americans, and I didn't think this was possible, who get winded going downstairs. It's a real thing. And I know we're supposed to be like, everything bad is good, but my goodness, we are so intellectually, emotionally, physically, spiritually lazy that it's like a metaphor. Huffing and puffing going downstairs, it's like, all right, this isn't probably good in any aspect.
So, Colin, what's your sign, man?
That's another thing. See, you're in a fortunate situation. You are, as I like to say, out of the pool. You have your family and your wife and your kids.
Thank God, because I would die out there.
You can actually track it and see it get worse each year. You see how we devolve by being on social media or online dating apps each year, because the same people who... they just start off with screeds, a lot of them saying, you better hate cops. If you voted for Trump, go hang yourself. It's like, wow, okay, that's not something people would have said 4 years ago, where you're just leading with this anger and this self-loathing. But on something like Tinder, you have a limited number of characters with which to work. And yet every single person, if they say one thing about themselves, it will be what their star sign is. And if they say a second thing, it will be to add the other star signs with which they feel they are compatible. That means, and it can be a veterinarian, it can be a doctor, because those are more kind of the people that I guess I'm sort of like looking towards. And they're going to say the star sign thing. They honestly believe that their persona is in some way shaped, or largely shaped, by how close the Earth was to the sun when they popped out into this world. That's like some real voodoo witch, where are the stones type of stuff. That's nuts. So I gave like the example of my cardiologist, and he's the only doctor I have the courage to face. He's the guy I try to impress. I go up and down the monument for. It's for him, Dr. Autry, my guy. If I wanted to see him when I get up the courage again, and he says, oh, you know, I have to ask you, what's your star sign? You know how quickly I'd flee? I mean, who would... oh, yeah, okay, I'm a Virgo. I don't even want people to know that. That's not my real star. Don't worry about that.
Mine they even changed. I'm a Cancer. Not that I have no idea what that means, except for a while we weren't even Cancer, because, you know, that had a bad connotation. So they turned us into moon children for a while.
That sounds like you would have been Frank Zappa's kid.
Exactly. Exactly. Here's what I know, and I pay no attention to this at all, but I don't know where I was. I must have been out to dinner with people or something like that, and we had, you know, one of those little, I think around here it's the coffee news, which is a little thing that, a little flyer that comes out in restaurants to kill the time while you're waiting for your food to come, and they had horoscopes in there. And we started reading through them, and what does everybody say? When you read a horoscope, they always say, oh, my God, That's exactly right. But then if you listen to everybody else's, you realize theirs are exactly right for you as well, because that's how they write those stupid things.
You could be all of them. You're like,
yes,
horoscope. Like, you are the Christ of horoscope. You read through them. It's like, oh, I am. I'm like, I'm Saturn. I'm Jesus. I'm all of these things. I inhabit all of it. And I don't know how somebody can honestly think something like that. But worst for me is the position it puts me in as, it's like, what do you do if you know better than that, because you're not, whatever you wish to call it, like, what do you do? Do you try to make allowances for it? This is the thing, when you are in the soup, this fetid soup of this pool, and all you want to do is get out, and you envy your friends who are on their island, far away from the deep end of the pool, and they just inhabit that island with their friends and their family, their circumscribed little group, and thank their lucky stars that they are not in this gelatinous group of torment.
I would run the monument again, except then I got to deal with those people who go, wow, it's easier coming down than it is going up. Did you notice that, sir?
I go around the turn, and I hear people coming down, and I actually try to will them into not staying. I don't know why I let it bother me so much. I'm like, come on, man, don't do it. It's like, ah, you did it. Like, seriously, you really don't know? How could you not know? And it's the same people, too, who I pass, like, so many times. And people, like I said, they're laboring in there. And I was wearing today a light gray Beanpot T-shirt. And it looked on the front like the sweat was like a chest protector if you were a catcher or something. I'm going down the stairs, and this person, this vastig individual, is like, yeah, you gave up, huh? Like, what, where are your powers of deduction, man? I've gone past you four times. We're not at the same level of fitness. You think I perspired this much? Like, I have some horrible leprosy type of disease that I've probably just given to you by going halfway up this bad boy? And then I'm offended at him, and he hasn't even said a thing about going down, and yet he will when I pass him a few moments after that going back up.
Next week, Colin, because it's going to take us a while, I want to get into the idea of applying the standards of today to yesterday, as if, as you pointed out in our communication, that we were in the age of enlightenment here in America. But we're a little bit short on time. But I want to talk about this, because you posted it yesterday, and we were talking about it on the air. Carrie and I were talking about it off the air. The idea that they would play Strange Fruit in the middle of Starbucks, and how you were likely the only person there who realized the irony of that.
I heard it again. I was there for a few hours.
Whoa.
I heard it a second time, and it came on, and so it must be in their rotation now. And you wonder about the vetting process of that. Everybody talks about, like, I'm so woke. You're so woke that you don't even know who Billie Holiday is, and you don't listen to her, and you don't know what she's saying. So maybe you're just a hypocrite, and you should start and go out and actually learn something. But it comes on, and it is actually a very long introduction to this song, which you don't really think about. But it goes on for a while. It gives her a lot of buildup before she comes in to say what she has to say. And I looked around, and people are still just staring at their phone. And I'm thinking, man, this is one of the most galvanizing, gutting, searing, important works of art. It might be the most important song in the history of recorded sound. And notice it, people. Notice it. In Starbucks, it's great that you've let this slip through, but clearly this song about lynching was an accident, because they weren't aware enough of what they were putting on the sound system.
Yeah, all while they're ordering a venti latte.
I listened to it twice. It stops me. It doesn't matter how many times I hear it. I will stop what I'm doing, because I have no choice but to stop what I'm doing, because it matters. Most of what happens right now and occurs and is touted, it doesn't matter at all. It's ephemeral. It could be something else. It could be its opposite. But this is the stuff of why humans are here. And we should be talking about this at the Starbucks after it plays. And we should say, oh, my goodness, did you feel that? Do you want to discuss this? Let's get a coffee. And instead, no, it's just one lonely sea dog looking around this place saying, where is my future amazing woman who's not going to not know what gravity is and yet should have and big Billie Holiday with me and all of that great stuff.
She's not interested in Virgos because she's a Sagittarius.
Well, we have everything. We're clicking on those other things, and we're 3 out of 4, and we're batting 750. I'll allow. As long as we agree that it never ever comes up in the following.
You'll be like, yeah, the moon was in the seventh house. Yes, absolutely,
Colin. Well, maybe I'll try to recruit you. Like, you know what, man? Remember that time I was being like, you know, kind of a wise ass on your show. I'm into this, dude. I have a little druid hood I wear and everything. Get Carrie into it. We'll have a Bangor chapter of the Star Sign Boys.
I want the pictures. I want to see it all. By the way, the downtown shirt headed out in the mail should be arriving very soon for you.
All right. I appreciate that.
Yeah, we're looking forward to seeing how good you look drenching that sucker in sweat in the middle of the monument.
Yeah, Emma gave me a hard time about that, by the way. She's like, oh, Kimball ripped you. I'm like, what the hell, you little snot? I don't need this from you. She's like, yeah, I got you.
It's not ripping. That's an appreciation of what you do on a regular basis.
I guess. All right, my friend.